Good evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Here are some of the stories we are covering today, Wednesday, July 15, 2015. A senior South Sudanese official issues a warning to the United Nations mission in South Sudan after Juba revokes a decision to expel top of UN official in Unity State.
There is an authority in this country. Please try and resolve them with the local authorities first before you just inform your headquarters. They write every small problem. Even somebody in a nightclub, it will be transmitted to New York.
And South Sudanese ambassador to the United Nations praises the UN Special Force in Abyei for doing a good job under difficult circumstances.
The UNISFA force, this is the interim protection force for Abyei, is, although not the ideal, is doing a lot to mitigate the continuous attacks on the Dinka.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. South Sudan's foreign minister has revoked the decision by the Unity State Council of Ministers to expel the UNMISS state coordinator from Bentiu. Barnaba Marielle Benjamin says Mary Cummins, who was asked not to return to the state capital Bentiu, will soon resume her work in Unity State. Marielle says his ministry met with the Unity State Governor Joseph Montuil about the standoff between UNMISS and state authorities. UNMISS released a report last month on human rights violations committed by government forces, including alleged cases of killing civilians and raping women and girls before burning them alive to destroy evidence.
We have already resolved it. I have discussed it here with the deputy representative of the special representative of the Secretary General. And these are administrative issues, really. They don't have to go to the level of New York. We can always resolve it. And I think we have resolved it with the governor, and we have informed the deputy to the special representative of the United Nations.
So what is the latest? Is the UN official returning to Bentiu?
Yes, she will be able to go back to Bentiu, yes.
When is she going back?
When she would want her to go back, anytime she wants to go back according to her work, that will be as soon as the governor is back in Unity State, the signal will be given and she will go back. But the fact is, she will go back to her work.
This is not the first time the government is not happy with the United Nations mission in South Sudan. Is there any particular problem that is making your government not happy with the UN mission in South Sudan?
No, well, there are individual cases where sometimes some of the officials of the UN actually carry actions beyond their actual mandate in the country. Because this country is a country with a constitution. It is a country with a government and authority. And you also need an individual, although with all the immunities they have, you need to do things within the law of the country. So there are cases, isolated cases. The problem is that these cases which happen, they are just quickly transferred to UN Security Council. As if every small problem in South Sudan seems to go before it is even the authorities in the country are informed. That's why it seems as if there is any problem. But there is really no problem between us and the UN. They are warmly welcome. What we are telling them is that there is an authority in this country. Please try and resolve them with the local authorities first before you just inform your headquarters. They write every small problem. Even somebody in a nightclub, it will be transmitted to New York.
But in this case that happened in Bentiu, did the UN break any law?
No, it was not investigated. It was the report which was given was not shared with the local authorities. If you are in Unity State and you have certain concerns of indiscipline, please, why don't you raise it first with the local authorities rather than taking it to be true and you give an immediate report on something you have not shared with the government? Because the report which was given was not shared with the government. It was not shared with the local state government nor with the national government.
And how would you react to people who are saying, especially the international aid agencies, who are saying that there are just too many bureaucracy in South Sudan? They say you go to an area, the military commander is even himself a government. You have the commissioner, who is also another government. You have the Payam administrator, who is another government.
No.
So there's a lot of chain of command before they could reach the appropriate people. It looks like there's a little bit of disorder there.
That is an exaggeration. In fact, if there is one country where the NGOs are so free, it is the Republic of South Sudan, where the government, including the leadership, have given them a free movement throughout the territory. That is in South Sudan. There were a few cases, and those cases have been resolved very clearly. The NGOs have been briefed by the government at the highest level of government that they are to move everywhere, but provided that the local authorities and the government is informed for their own security. You cannot move on your own as if you are moving inside a cathedral or a church. This is a country as huge as anything else, and there are laws. There is rebellion in a part of the country. So the government would want to know where you go to, even for their own security.
That's South Sudan's Foreign Minister, Barnaba Marial Benjamin. He was speaking to me from Juba earlier today. The United Nations has renewed the mandate for the interim security force in Abyei or UNISFA for 5 more months. South Sudan and Sudan both claim Abyei as their territory. Francis Deng, South Sudan's ambassador to the United Nations, said in a statement to the UN Security Council yesterday that UNISFA mandate has some shortcomings, but it has reduced the number of attacks on the Ngok Dinka by nomadic Meseria. Deng says insecurity is the main problem in Abyei.
The UNISFA force is, although not the ideal, is doing a lot to mitigate the continuous attacks on the Dinka. And I also make the point that despite the identification of those who have been responsible for these continuous attacks of the area and killings of people, there has never been any arrest, no accountability whatsoever.
And you said in the statement that a refinement of the present arrangements under the UN's interim security force in Abyei could turn the area into an international protectorate. What did you mean by that?
We need more comprehensive governmental structures. We need services. We need infrastructure. And we need development for the area. If these were done, and people are assured of their security and some of these additional services, it would at least ease the situation and make any dialogue about the future status of Abyei more cordial than it is now.
It's been said that the Meseria are armed by the Sudanese government, but the Ngok Dinka are also armed. Who is arming them?
Abyei is supposed to be weapons-free. But what has been the case is the Meseria, with the much heavier support from the government, comes to attack a people who are helpless, who are not armed. And therefore, when the government of South Sudan tried to be supportive of the police in the area, now the UN, of course, always says certain elements come from the south with arms, and this is a violation. Elements come from the north, and thereby making it seem to be equal, balanced, but it is not. The support for the Meseria is much heavier.
There was great hope that the Abyei Joint Oversight Committee would resolve conflict between the two groups, but many complained that it has not done much else to bring peace to that region. What's your reaction?
Well, the effectiveness of AJOC is totally dependent on the cooperation between the two countries, between the two governments. What I understand from the head of mission in Abyei is that the ordinary people do want peace, do want to coexist, and want to restore the good old days of cordial ties between the Dinka and the Meseria. But the politics of some, what you might call political entrepreneurs, more or less mostly based in Khartoum and always extending their influence over the area, to antagonize the Dinka and actually make relations between the two communities hostile. In the end, it does not benefit the Meseria and it does not benefit the Ngok Dinka.
Ambassador, I'm aware that you are from Abyei. How do you feel that the place you call home is unstable?
Obviously, I care about the South, which is clearly the people of Abyei are identified with. Nobody questions that the people of IBA are Southerners. It's only a contest of either political interest or control by the government or the resources in the area. IBA is often described as the oil-rich area. If you go to IBA, you see nothing. Basically, the people of IBA, you know, they're Southerners. They want to join the South, but in addition to being Southerners and wanting to be part of the South, they are neglected by the government in Khartoum.
That's Francis Deng, South Sudan's ambassador to the United Nations, speaking to South Sudan in Focus reporter Ayen Bior from New York yesterday. Meanwhile, in Juba, traditional leaders are meeting to brainstorm on how to bring an everlasting peace to South Sudan. As Philip Thornaleo reports for VOA from Juba, the chiefs say one way of restoring peace is to use South Sudan's customary laws to compensate families who have lost loved ones in the violence.
The sponsor of the meeting, the United Nations Development Programme, or UNDP, brought 30 chiefs to Juba from 9 of South Sudan's 10 states for the talks. Because none of the chiefs read or write English, a member of South Sudan's local government board, Nikdimo Arunuman, read out a statement and spoke on their behalf. Man says the traditional leaders went to play a role in meeting out justice once the conflict is over. The chiefs went reparations for victims of the conflict to be handled in the traditional way, the statement says.
For example, if somebody kill somebody from the other side in his community, they either always they sit down. The people of the disease and the offense, those people, they will say, okay, instead of this person to be killed or to be hanged to death, it is better that they pay us the blood compensation in form of cattle or in form of money in other cases, because there's 64 communities, all of them are those who have cattle and there are some who have money.
The chiefs describe the 19-month conflict in South Sudan as destructive and call for it to stop. They say the people of South Sudan must be involved in finding a lasting solution and ending the violence.
We also urge the warring parties to pay close attention to represent the interests of the conflict-affected people of the South Sudan and to inform the traditional leaders and the South Sudanese public about the peace negotiations. We take note of the importance that a solution to conflicts in South Sudan must come from South Sudanese.
The chiefs note that the conflict has increased the number of weapons in the hands of civilians. The traditional leaders are calling for a nationwide disarmament campaign in which civilians will surrender their weapons and firearms will be destroyed. They say that the broader conflict between forces loyal to President Salva Kiir and Riek Machar's armed opposition group and smaller local disputes needed to be resolved if peace is to be restored in South Sudan. They recognize that they cannot resolve all the violence in South Sudan on their own.
We call upon the international community, the donors community, and the government to support traditional structures relating to the settlement of intercommunal disputes, including the Council of Traditional Leaders, Kotals, so that it can lead to negotiation at the grassroots level.
Nyan Jong Lual is the only female chief attending the workshop. She says ending the conflict will lift some of the huge burden of suffering of South Sudanese women.
It will be to our benefit if this war stops, because we are the mothers of the children and wives of the husbands who are dying in this conflict.
Women have also been victim of rape and other atrocities during the conflict. The chiefs are meeting 2 weeks before talks led by East African bloc IGAD are due to resume in Addis Ababa. The traditional leaders say that for the recommendations to have the intended result of ending the violence in South Sudan, they should have a seat at the table at the upcoming talks. For BOA News, I am Philip Thornaleo in Juba.
You are tuned to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Coming up, we take a look at President Obama's visit to Kenya. That story is coming up.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today:
what is the funny story that your family tells about you?
I remember one day while I was on the phone, I was communicating to a friend. Then my mom thought I was maybe communicating to a boyfriend. And so I was like, "You girls, you don't want to come and work outside here? You don't want to come and help me with domestic work? Hey, you communicate with these boys. Hey, hello, hello, on phone."
The funny story my family always tells me about when I was young, I used to not like to take shower, even brushing. Whenever my mom or my dad tells me, "Wake up, go and brush," I go around behind the house, I take my own time, and I don't do that.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
You are listening to South Sudan in Focus. A United Nations report on AIDS says the Millennium Development Goals of reducing HIV infections and AIDS-related deaths have been met. Mata Vonderwolf reports for VOA from Addis Ababa.
According to UN statistics, since the year 2000, new HIV infections have fallen by 35% and AIDS-related deaths by 41%. UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon outlined the good news to reporters in Addis Ababa on Tuesday.
"Today, 15 million people are on life-saving HIV treatment. We have proved beyond doubt that treatment can be scaled up no matter what the setting. 15 million people on HIV treatment means millions of families are protected and billions of dollars saved. And it means we are on our way for an AIDS-free generation."
Sub-Saharan Africa has always been the worst affected part of the world when it comes to AIDS. But progress is being made, with Namibia, Senegal and Ethiopia being examples of countries that have significantly reduced new HIV infections. The report says access to treatment has saved about 7.8 million lives worldwide. Treatment also means that an estimated 1.4 million children did not receive HIV from their mothers. Also, UNAIDS Executive Director Michel Sidibe said that starting 6 to 8 months from now, HIV-positive people will be able to stop taking their daily pills.
"Soon, we know that we will have one injection for every 4 months or 6 months, so which is changing completely the way we will deliver services to poor people. They will not have to travel. They will not have to come. They will not have to stock, certainly, those pills and to have a risk to have pills which are not necessarily working, which creating resistance."
The injection will reduce the cost of treatment for those affected. Despite these promising developments, more needs to be done. In 2014, there were still 2 million new HIV infections, and more than 13 million children lost one or both parents to AIDS-related causes. Later this year, the UN Millennium Development Goals will be replaced with the Sustainable Development Goals. The new target for 2030 is to completely eradicate the AIDS epidemic and for everyone to have access to treatment. Marta van der Wolf for VOA News, Addis Ababa.
A new report indicates journalists in Kenya face some of the same struggles of journalists in South Sudan. The U.S.-based Committee to Protect Journalists has released a report on what it calls the worst climate for press freedom in Kenya. The media advocacy group says Kenyan journalists face repressive legislation and increasing physical threats. Hilary Hiller has more for VOA from Nairobi.
The report, released Wednesday, paints a bleak picture of Kenya's media, long considered the most robust in East Africa. It documents cases of journalists being beaten, arrested, and intimidated for their work, especially outside the capital, Nairobi. CPJ's Tom Rhodes says that since Kenyan President Uhuru Kenyatta came to power 2 years ago, journalism has become a more dangerous profession.
"I've counted since the beginning of this year and documented 19 cases from January to May 2015 of attacks, threats, imprisonments, and harassments of the Kenyan press, which basically works out to be one case per week. And in all 4 years that I've been here in Kenya, I've never seen such high levels before.
What makes this trend more worrisome, he adds, is that this intimidation takes place with almost complete impunity.
What has happened in all of these cases? To date, nothing. And this is, I think, one of the reasons why we're seeing this increase in cases is simply because it can happen. It's allowed to happen.
Rhodes says most of the cases documented this year have involved Kenyan officials or police and tend to revolve around topics like land disputes, corruption, security, and the International Criminal Court. The result, says Rhodes, is that certain topics have become no-go areas for the Kenyan press. Government officials say journalists aren't in any danger, but Kenya has passed a series of recent laws impacting press freedom, many of which have been challenged and are tied up in court. These include a law limiting the media's right to report on security issues, and another forbidding journalists from handling classified information. Official harassment doesn't stop at the formal media, the CPJ report adds. It says the government has been cracking down on social media as well, and a number of people have been arrested for blogging about certain subjects or for posting on the social media site Facebook. Hillary Hewler for VOA News, Nairobi.
U.S. President Barack Obama is to visit Kenya after his month, U.S. President Barack Obama is to visit Kenya later this month, the country of his father's birth, for the first time since becoming president. For VOA News, Muhammad Yusuf traveled to Obama's family ancestral homeland, a small village in western Kenya, to see how its residents have benefited from their association with the U.S. president.
A remote rural village in western Kenya, Kogelo, is where the father of U.S. President Barack Obama was born. Once a sleepy village, it came into the limelight 10 years ago when Mr. Obama became a U.S. senator. Today, Kogelo has grown, with paved roads, electricity and schools. Things rarely found in other villages in the country. In this village, there is a strong sense of hope among the children, according to Manessa Oyucho, the head teacher at Senator Barack Obama Primary School. In the past decade, the number of children in his school has doubled.
The other members of the community who are not taking their children to school copied that. And many, many parents took their children to various schools. And that's why many people are learned in Kogelo.
Part of the school sits on Obama family ancestral land, and Oyucho says the Obamas are a role model for what can be achieved with education.
The children are interested in learning up to university and becoming leaders, and they believe they will become leaders in various areas. The children are convinced that education is power.
Over the years, the name Obama has sparked some developments, like roads. Wesley Onyango Obama says the development has opened the village up to the rest of the region. He says if he has anything to sell now, he can take it to Kisumu, Ndori or Luanda Kotieno with ease. But he says before it was a nightmare. Another Kogelo resident, carpenter George Ogelo, says the village is now seeing more visitors from all over the world. He says there's an increase in the number of people visiting here because this is where the president is from. This is one of the things that makes people from here happy, and everything that happens here, people like it. During his Africa visit later this month, President Obama will participate in a global entrepreneurship summit in Kenya. Mr. Obama visited Kogelo in 2006 as a U.S. senator, and people from the village hope he will find time again to visit his father's birthplace. Mohamed Yusuf for VOA News, Kogelo, Western Kenya.
You are listening to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Here are a summary of some of our top stories with South Sudan in Focus editor Carol Van Damme.
Thanks, John. South Sudan's foreign minister has revoked a Unity State Council of Ministers decision to expel the UNMISS state coordinator from Bentiu. Barnaba Mario Benjamin says Mary Cummins, who was asked not to return to the state capital of Bentiu, will soon resume her work in Unity State. Mario says his ministry met with the Unity State governor about the standoff between UNMISS and state authorities. It came about after UNMISS reported human rights violations committed by government forces, including alleged cases of killing civilians and raping women and girls before burning them alive to destroy the evidence. The United Nations has renewed the mandate for its interim security force in the disputed region of Abyei, or UNISFA, for 5 months. South Sudan and Sudan have both claimed Abyei as part of their territory. South Sudan Ambassador to the United Nations, Francis Deng, told the United Nations Security Council yesterday that the UNISFA mandate has some shortcomings, but that it has reduced the number of overall attacks on the Nuk Dinka, who make up the majority of the population in Abyei. Deng says insecurity is one of the main problems in Abyei as it stands now. And finally, at least 5 women are among a group of 40 fistula patients from throughout northern Bahar el Ghazal state in South Sudan who are stranded in a wheel after having been promised urgently needed surgery. Their operations were postponed this week due to the Ramadan holiday celebrated by Muslims. The women say they cannot afford to go home or pay for their lodging in a wheel while they await their operations in Wau. And that is a recap of some of today's top South Sudan stories. I'm Carol Van Dam.
That's our show for this Wednesday. We now leave you with the song Alama Sudan by Mo Attack Mo. We have been listening to the US-based South Sudanese musician Mo Attack Mo with the song Alam Sudan. This one goes out to our listeners in Kajokeji, Torit, Yambio, Meridi, Bor, Kwajok, and Juba. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Thanks for listening. Join us again tomorrow for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Alam Sudan.